Hello, survivalists. Thanks for listening and welcome to another episode of the Crux True Survival Stories podcast. I'm your host, Casey McIntosh. As we celebrate reaching our 100th episode milestone, we're bringing you something special. In our next two episodes, we'll revisit some of our most popular survival stories. I'll provide narration highlighting the crux of each individual tale, along with key takeaways that listeners can apply to their own lives. Join us as we reflect on the incredible journeys of survival that have captivated our audience. Let's dive into these extraordinary stories. First, we delve into the harrowing tale of Autumn Beach, a 16-year-old who found herself facing unimaginable challenges while visiting her grandparents in Montana during the summer of 2015. As Autumn prepared to return home to Bellingham, Washington with her grandparents in their small aircraft, little did she know the perilous journey that lay ahead.
Autumn Beach, who's 16 years old and visiting her grandparents in Montana in the summer of 2015. Her grandparents had planned to fly her back to her home in Western Washington in their small aircraft, but later that day, the plane would go down over the Northern Cascades. On Saturday, July 11th, 2015, Autumn was preparing to return home to Bellingham, Washington from Kalispell, Montana. They had originally planned to drive back to Washington, but last minute, Autumn's step-grandfather offered to fly her home instead of driving in the family's aircraft, a Beechcraft A-35. The morning had nothing but bad weather. They waited all morning for things to get better. However, when it became apparent that the weather would not improve, they left anyway around 1 o'clock. Leland and Sharon Bowman, Autumn's grandparents, manned the cockpit while Autumn sat in the back. They planned on landing the plane in Linden, Washington, where Autumn's boyfriend would pick her up when they landed. About 90 minutes into the flight, however, the plane was engulfed in fog. Autumn's grandparents kept their cool, and they were continuing to navigate through the fog using a tablet. But suddenly their signal cut out, and they were flying blind through the fog. And then the bottom of the plane began to scrape trees. It seemed like things were moving in slow motion. They skidded along, mowing down trees until the propeller tipped nose stuck into the ground. They skidded along, mowing down trees until the propeller tipped into the ground, nose down. Autumn said later about the crash, "Everything was white, like everything, all the windows. Everything was white, and suddenly it was all trees, and then it was fire." Autumn said that she never lost consciousness, but she can't recall exiting the plane. The plane itself was already on fire when she slipped outside. Meanwhile, both of her grandparents were still alive and trapped inside the plane. She knew that they were in there because she could hear them screaming. Autumn tried to pull Leland, her grandfather, out of the plane. He was closest to the door. The other side wasn't really accessible to get to her grandmother. She kept telling him to unbuckle his seatbelt, but he had most likely sustained a concussion from the crash, and he was very disoriented. He couldn't really comprehend to go through with that. And everything's on fire. She's trying to free him, but burned her right hand badly in the effort. She ended up with second-degree burns from trying to get him out of the plane. And ultimately, the flames drove her back away from the plane. Autumn's face was burned, her hair scorched, and her eyelashes shriveled. Soon the yelling stopped, and Autumn knew it was over. She mentioned later, "I'm a small person, and there's only so much I could do." This article I read said that survivors also underestimate how fast a fire can consume a whole plane, like 90 seconds.
Wow.
So you have a minute and a half to get out. So you don't have time to wait for anybody to come and get you if you're in a plane crash. You need to get out. And another mistake people make is trying to get all their baggage or things off of the plane when they need to just be out of it. Autumn said later, "The smell of burning flesh is really unpleasant, and it was hurting my heart. So I started going downhill. I was, what's the word, just full of adrenaline and not really present. I ended up tumbling over the side of a cliff. It wasn't a really big one, but it was enough for me to fall on my back. At that point, I was like, okay, I need to think for a second." The aircraft had dropped off radar at 3:21 p.m. The last cell signal from the occupants vanished at 3:49. And they had left around 1 o'clock.
What was the weather doing at this point?
It was very wet. Autumn had recalled in survival shows that she had watched with her dad a couple key tactics to survival. Her and her dad would watch a lot of shows like Man vs. Wild. So a big thing in Man vs. Wild is to travel downhill and also follow water.
Mm-hmm.
Autumn thought she heard this faint sound of a freeway, and she followed, but it turned out to be running water. So back to the weather. It was terribly wet. The clouds were spitting. The ground was saturated with water. And Autumn soon found herself soaked. She followed the water for hours, and as she followed, it began to grow wider and deeper. The afternoon turned into evening, and Autumn found herself physically and emotionally exhausted. The death of her grandparents was weighing heavily on her, but the enormity of the situation was not lost on her either. She knew that her survival at this point was so important. All right. That night, she climbed onto a ledge above the river to sleep. She wasn't worried about wild animals, snakes or bears. Instead, she was thinking just a single thought. I'm going to die.
While also being wet,
she was worried that hypothermia would be the culprit. She realized that it had been a poor choice to continuously cross the creek as well. But there was nothing to be done about it now. Her clothes were wet, and she took them off and piled them up. She was wearing a tank top and wrapped herself in the cardigan that she had.
She's in the middle of nowhere in the wilderness.
Yeah, exactly. She was hard-pressed to get any sleep, especially with the fact that she has second-degree burns. The next morning, she puts on her wet clothes and resumes her march. She feels worse than she had the day before. After nearly an hour of walking, she had hardly any hope for continuing. And she said that she lay down against a tree just to die. She stared there for a while. Autumn said in an interview, "Somehow I got motivation. I was angry. I was like, this isn't fair. How come I have to die right now? I have so many things I want to do." To help herself get through, Autumn started to sing songs to herself and started to tell the story of her trek aloud. She wondered if she was on the news. She wondered what her boyfriend and family were thinking. The next night was worse than the first. She slept along the river, where she was bitten repeatedly by sand fleas. Waking the next morning, she hurt. Her muscles were stiff and sore from the exertion and dehydration, and her skin was itchy and chafing from all the insect bites and sand in her clothes. But as she's walking along, she finally sees a wooden bridge materialize through the trees. And at first, she thinks she's hallucinating. But then, as she continued, it became obvious that this was real life. So Autumn came up to the bridge. It's next to a main road. She goes over there, and she stood for an hour, frantically waving at passing vehicles.
What?
Yeah. It was Monday, July 13th, which is two full days after the plane had gone missing. Autumn said she knew that she looked like Freddy Krueger, but says she was clearly distressed and still nobody stopped. So she returned to a parking lot near the bridge where a single car was parked. She noticed while she was waiting that there's a trailhead by this bridge, and the trailhead is called Easy Pass. Not so easy.
Not so easy.
30 minutes later, another car pulled into the lot, and that's when Autumn started crying. The people who had pulled in provided Gatorade, and they drove her back to Mazama, where she made a 911 call. That call apparently went viral. So that's Autumn's survival story. Autumn doesn't go out of her way to give information about the crash, but she is willing to share her story, and she knows that it gives some people a sense of hope. And she did work with an author to write a book about her experience. It's called Getting Out Alive, The Autumn Beach Story. And it's written by Tara Ellis.
When learning about Autumn's story, the thing that stuck out to me the most was the fact that Autumn had to leave her grandparents in a burning airplane and then had to face her own survival in the middle of nowhere. Here's some of the things that Autumn did that helped her survive the situation. Number one, she took swift actions. Autumn's story highlights the critical importance of acting swiftly in emergency situations. She only had a minute and a half before the plane was engulfed to get out of it. Clearly, in these situations, hopefully none of you were ever stuck in a burning airplane, but the main name of the game in this story is get out of the plane. Number two is if you're in the middle of the nowhere wilderness, one of the helpful tips that you could take from this story is to travel downhill and follow water sources. In this story, Autumn drew from survival shows and lessons from her father. Autumn recognized the importance of traveling downhill and following water sources to increase her chances of rescue. The third thing that Autumn did was she had resilience and mental toughness. Despite facing physical injuries, exhaustion, and too much emotional turmoil, Autumn found some inner strength to persevere. Her determination to survive fueled with anger and desire to live. In our next segment, we're going to the California wilderness to discuss an avid biker's confrontation with a mountain lion, one of the most terrifying outdoor experiences I think one could ever have. On January 8, 2004, Aniela's ordinary day of mountain biking in Whiting Ranch Wilderness Park took a terrifying turn. It was January 2004, and Ann and her friend Debbie set out for a mountain bike ride. She wanted to do a 45-minute ride at Whiting Ranch, which was a 10-minute drive away from her home. It was a loop trail. Whiting Ranch Wilderness Park is a 2,500-acre expanse of oak woodland and canyons, grasslands, and steep slopes of sage. The area also has some beautiful red rock. There's a canyon there. There's also a few streams that meander through the park, and each of those streams are home to an abundance of wildlife. There was also a cattle ranch there back in the day, so there's some remnants of the cattle ranch that still linger in the area. There are 23 trails, and there are 17 miles of single track that are utilized by hikers and horseback riders. Anne was not planning on being out for long. They started their journey around 3:45, and as they rounded a corner, the pair saw a man standing on the trail. He had a bike, but he was also standing with another bike, and whoever was owning the bike that was just sitting there by itself was missing in action. The person they saw on the trail just said, "Hey, I'm looking for this person who abandoned their bike." The women didn't really think a whole lot about that, and they just kept going, and they were at a part of the trail where they started beating up. There were some turns and twists in the trail. And out of the corner of her eye, Anne sees some reddish brownish fur. And at first she just thought it was a deer. And I'm sure it's like it is here where deer are everywhere. But unfortunately for her, this was not a deer. So only a brief moment later, the creature leapt up and attacked her. She knew right away that it was a mountain lion because nothing else attacks like that. In an article for The Guardian, she said, quote, "I felt like getting hit by a truck. I was slammed to the ground and it knocked the wind out of me. I could not believe this was happening." The mountain lion grabbed onto Anne's shoulders and attempted to bite down to her neck. It began dragging her towards the ravine by the back of her neck. She was trying to yell and she tried to punch the lion in the face, but it did not deter the beast at all. It pulled her for a short distance, and then it started to reposition its grip on her left ear and the left side of her face. And at that point, she recognized that it was attempting to get her by the front of the neck. It was just moving its mouth around. She was crying out to Debbie, and finally she saw Debbie, and Debbie was just yelling and screaming. Debbie actually grabs on to Anne's leg as the lion is attempting to pull Anne into the bushy ravine. At this point, the lion intensified its attempts to secure its prey. It bit down on her face, and at that moment, she felt the flesh of her face tear off and was surprised at how easily it happened. I saw in one account she was saying it was like a knife cutting through butter, slicing through butter, a hot knife. The cougar is pulling her head, and Debbie is pulling her leg. Anne starts to try to say goodbye to Debbie. She was under the impression that this was going to be it. Then the lion grabs the front of her neck, and then she starts getting this feeling of a dark sensation. She was thinking, this is the end of my life. She feels this sensation of peace and relaxation. But then there's also this moment of remembrance of for her husband and her daughter, who's only an 8-year-old at the time. As Debbie is screaming, there were some other onlookers in the area who were also recreating. One of them went back and called EMS once they realized what was happening. And two other onlookers started throwing rocks at the lion. They were all yelling at it. Two of the rocks hit the lion's body.
The third one hit it in the head, and that was the rock that finally deterred the lion, and it finally released Anne.
Oh, thank goodness.
After the lion released Anne, she came to. She regained her senses. When she came to, she was choking on her own blood, and she felt a little bit like she was drowning. She also felt like there was a giant stake stapled to her left cheek where the lion had torn off the flesh on her face. At first, she was thinking about her left eye, but then she realized that she could see. And once she recognized that she could see out of both of her eyes, she felt confident in that moment that she was going to be okay. It took the paramedics 19 minutes to arrive at the scene. And what is really unnerving to me is that the helicopter pilot actually visualized the mountain lion crouching down in a pouncing position, waiting for the opportunity to obtain more human prey at the point at which the helicopter was coming down to rescue her. It was wasting no time. It was just hanging out, waiting for the next opportunity. Anne later discovered that the owner of the abandoned bike was attacked and killed by the same mountain lion that she'd been attacked by, this man named Mark Reynolds, who's apparently very athletic, and he didn't survive because he was by himself. Anne felt very strongly that she wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for her friend Deb. And according to an ABC article, Anne's husband fainted upon seeing her and her injuries after this cougar incident. And the night of her attack, she underwent a six-hour surgery. And her trauma surgeon said her wounds were some of the worst he had ever seen. And out of the 20 puncture wounds she had, which were all deep, none of them hit her esophagus, her voice box, her trachea, or her carotid artery, but in some areas were millimeters away from her carotid artery. Her story made it into a documentary segment on Fight to Survive that's titled, "This Woman Survived a Brutal Mountain Lion Attack." She also wrote a book that's titled Skin Deep. I was just going to go through a couple tips real quick about what you can do when it comes to protecting yourself and just trying to recreate in areas where cougars live. So first of all, just take a friend with you. Avoid going into cougar country alone is a good idea. You should be aware of your surrounding. Pay attention to where you are and you don't wear headphones. Another consideration was to bring along a whistle or an air horn that could scare an animal away, and to keep your dog on a leash that's 6 feet long or less. Also, not to run away from a cougar if a cougar is coming after you. And if you do encounter a cougar, you're supposed to face it directly, but don't look directly into its eyes because that might make you appear aggressive. And if the cougar displays aggressive behavior, you're supposed to look larger than you are. If you have a coat on and you can put it over your head, sticks, throwing rocks, making a bunch of noise, and don't approach the cougar. If there are cubs, be really careful to not get anywhere near them. And in the event that it does attack you, then you want to fight back. Our next story takes us to the jungle. After surviving a harrowing plane crash in the dense Amazon rainforest, Julianne Kopke's resilience and resourcefulness became the focal point for her remarkable story. But as Julianne navigated through the treacherous jungle, facing challenges range from injury to potential encounters with dangerous wildlife. Julianne Kopke was a 17-year-old girl when she boarded a Christmas Eve flight to see her father for Christmas after graduating from high school. Never again would her life be the same. Julianne was an only child born in Lima, Peru in 1954 as a German national. Her mother and father were scientists at the Museum of Natural History. Her father was a biologist, Hans William. Her mother was an ornithologist, Maria. When she turned 14, her parents set up a research station in the Amazon rainforest called Panguana. She lived there for at least a year and a half with her parents. Panguana is a biological research station located in a lowland rainforest at the western foothill of El Sierra mountain range, founded in 1968. This research area is not exactly really easy to get to. You have to cross this Pachitia River on foot for an hour and a half through forest and pastures, or you can take a two-hour boat ride. The research area is hilly with various bodies of water, swamp, forest, and some pastures and plantations along the western border areas. And the research station was really only designed for 5 years of research. Julianne was homeschooled by her parents, but she had to return to school in order to take her final exams and graduate with her class. in Lima, Peru. She graduated on December 23rd, 1971. And so at the time of her graduation, her mother, Maria, was actually working in Lima. She wanted to return to Panguana with Julianne on December 19th or 20th, but they ended up staying to attend Julianne's graduation ceremony. Their whole plan was to spend Christmas with her father. Julianne's mother booked a flight with Lanza Airline, which is Linhas Aéreas Nacionales, S.A., on a plane called a Lockheed L-188A Electra on Christmas Eve, with the Lanza Airline going against the recommendations of Julianne's father, who was really concerned about the safety of the flight because this airline actually had a terrible reputation and they had already lost two flights to crashes. They were just desperate to get home to spend Christmas with Julianne's father. Just a little bit about the Lockheed L-188 Electra. It's an American turboprop airliner built by Lockheed. It's the first turboprop airline built in the United States. And initially, the sales were really good, but then there were these two fatal crashes because of a design defect. And so sales were halted and no more planes were ordered. It initially had a lot of potential because it is really high power to the weight. And it had four engines. So there are 91 individuals loading on this plane, six crew members, 86 passengers. So two of the passengers were, of course, Julianne and her mother, Maria. And actually, they were really upset and irritated because the flight was leaving a couple hours later than its scheduled departure. Lanza Flight 508 departed Lima's George Chavez International Airport just before 12 p.m. on Christmas Eve, December 24th, 1971. They had a stop scheduled at Pequilpa. The final destination was Iquitos. So the craft is flying at 21,000 feet above sea level when the plane entered an area of severe thunderstorms and turbulence. The crew decided to keep going, even though they encountered bad weather, because they really had a lot of pressure to get people to their destinations before the holidays. Mm-hmm. At least this is what's speculated. They enter this really dark cloud and the plane starts just thrashing around, and Julianne's mother is really fearful and she's concerned. But Julianne wasn't really worried because she was comfortable flying. But 10 minutes into this severe turbulence, it was clear that there was really a major problem with the airplane. This is a direct quote from Julianne's experience, and this was from the BBC. "There was a very heavy turbulence, and the plane was jumping up and down. Parcels and luggage were falling from the locker. There were gifts, flowers, and Christmas cakes flying all around the cabin. When we saw lightning around the plane, I was scared. My mother and I held hands, but we were unable to speak. Other passengers began to cry and weep and scream. At 12:30 p.m. local time, a lightning strike ignited a fuel tank in the right wing. After about 10 minutes, I saw a very bright light on the outer engine at the left. My mother said very calmly, 'This is the end. It's all over.' Those were the last words I ever heard of her. The plane jumped down and went into a nosedive. It was pitch black and people were screaming. The deep roaring of the engines filled my head completely. Suddenly, the noise stopped and I was outside the plane. I was in a free fall, strapped to my seat and hanging head over heels. The whispering of the wind was the only noise I could hear. I felt completely alone. I could see the canopy of the jungle spinning towards me. Then I lost consciousness and I remembered nothing about the impact. Later, I learned that the plane had broken into pieces about 2 miles above the ground. The plane disintegrated following the lightning strike to the fuel tank." So it's estimated that this occurred 2 miles above the jungle floor. That's how far her free fall was.
That's a long way.
But she was strapped into her seat and she landed in heavy foliage in the jungle. She lost consciousness, as we mentioned, and she awoke 1 day later. Once she awoke, she realized that she had survived the crash. That was her first thought. And then she was like, "Where is my mother?" She became really concerned about her mother and she started looking around, but it doesn't seem like there was anything else in the area where she landed. There wasn't a bunch of plane wreckage or something like that. She gets up and starts assessing her injuries, and she had a concussion, of course, a broken collarbone, a cut to her right arm, and her right eye was swollen shut. She also had a torn ligament in her knee, but she was unaware of that knee injury, and she was able to walk on it. She could hear sounds of aircrafts flying overhead looking for wreckage, but it was just too thick with trees, and no one could actually see her. And luckily, she didn't panic. She didn't really think that the jungle was that dangerous. She'd spent a ton of time in the jungle at the research station.
If you haven't caught on, this is a survival podcast.
Yes.
But you would think with what her parents did, she would have a lot of background knowledge about her surroundings too and how to better survive. So I think that you would be a little bit more level-headed about it.
I would hope so.
Yeah. You would think that she would pick something up, one thing or two.
Yeah. So the Amazon rainforest is a moist, broadleaf tropical rainforest in the Amazon biome that covers most of the Amazon basin of South America. And this is a very large amount of space. So it encompasses 7 million kilometers squared. 5,500,000 kilometers squared are covered by rainforest. She basically said on a visit back to the area that the dangers of the jungle are basically misjudged. And she said this while standing in waters of the Rio Uyuhichis River, where there are stingrays, crocodiles, and piranhas in the water. She said that she was safe as piranhas are harmless in moving water, and crocodiles avoid you most of the time, and stingrays move when being prodded with a stick.
That's very interesting. I still probably wouldn't do what she's doing, but...
Also, there's mention about crocodiles jumping into the water when they see you, but really they're not coming after you. They're just trying to take cover. Mm. So she knew this and she didn't panic when they jumped into the water with her. So at the point at which she is assessing her situation, she is in basically a sleeveless mini dress and white sandals, but one of them had fallen off during the crash. And also Julianne was very nearsighted and she didn't have her glasses.
Well, I hope she didn't have surgery to correct her myopia.
I guess my point is she was blind, so she basically couldn't see very far in front of her. And what she was doing was using her foot with a shoe to step forward and feel out to see what was out there so she didn't step on a snake or something with her foot that didn't have a shoe on it.
Yeah, and it doesn't sound like a mini dress would be the ideal outfit for the jungle.
No, at least not for nighttime. So the only food that she had in her possession was a bag of sweets that landed near her seat and that fell from the plane. So she was mostly concerned about starving. She walked in the creek that she found because she thought it was the safest route to travel. And also I read somewhere that the whole concept of following this stream is that it brings you to people because people are going to be near water.
Sure.
And also, I guess you're not likely to step on a snake if you're walking through a stream.
Unless there's a water snake.
She was mentioning that snakes in the jungle look like piles of dry leaves.
Oh, yeah.
Oftentimes. And so
they're camouflaged.
Yeah, it's easy to step on them. But she thankfully didn't see any during her journey.
Well, of course she did.
She was just blind. I know. In some ways, maybe that was actually a blessing in disguise.
Yeah.
So it was hot and rainy during the day, and it was cool at night because of the clothes that she was wearing. And also it's like, are your clothes even dry at the point at which?
Oh, I'm sure not.
On the fourth day of her journey, she heard a noise of a landing king vulture. So she had learned about this animal from the research center. And so what she knew about this bird is that they're only going to land if there's a lot of carrion. She assumed at that point that the reason that these vultures were landing was because there were dead bodies from the airplane crash.
Oh my gosh. That's horrifying.
Yeah.
Just another good reason not to be able to see. Holy cow. I thought you were going to say because she looked like she was close to death and they were landing to pick her off, but that's worse.
Yeah. So she was finding her way down the creek on the fourth day and... she found a bench from the plane with three passengers rammed headfirst into the ground. So initially she felt super panicky because she'd never seen a dead body. And then she was thinking, is my mother one of those people?
Oh my gosh, can you imagine?
So then she gets closer and sees that the woman in this grouping of people had painted nails. And then she knew immediately that it wasn't her mother. And she felt a little bit of relief and then felt bad that she felt relieved. But she just kept trekking on at that point. By day 10, she was growing really weak, and she was lumbering along this larger river that she had found, and she was just feeling hopeless and alone at this point. And then she saw this large boat, but she thought that she was seeing, like, that she was hallucinating.
Mm-hmm.
And then she saw a path into the jungle where there was a hut with palm leaves on the roof, and she found a liter of gasoline at this hut. And you're going to really love this next part, Tessa. So she had this big arm wound, and it was infested with maggots.
Oh.
And so she sees this gasoline
tank. Did she
tank
on herself?
Yeah.
Stop it.
Yeah, she did. She poured the gasoline directly into her arm, the cut, because she'd seen her dad do this on their dog.
Oh, okay. Because I was like, that sounds bad.
Yeah, because their dog had a maggot infestation.
No, I just mean it sounds bad
for your body.
Living body.
She decides to stay at this little hut. And the next day she heard voices of men outside. And she said that she made mention that it was like hearing the voice of angels. She mentioned something about how they looked at her like she was this blonde-haired, white-skinned goddess, like water goddess or something. But I think they were just shocked to see somebody come out of the hut when they weren't probably expecting it. They actually treated her injuries, and they fed her, and they brought her back to civilization. One day later, right after she was brought back to civilization, she was reunited with her father. And I'm guessing he was pretty awestruck that she was alive. It had almost been 2 weeks at that point. It was like,
yeah,
she was brought back on day 12 or something. At this time, you know, they were looking for news of her mother and just wondering what happened to her. And on January 12th, they found her body. She was thought to have survived the crash, but she died a few days following the crash because of severe injuries and her inability to move.
Oh, so sad.
I know. And so just thinking about, I don't know what the distance was between where she landed and where Julianne landed. Julianne's survival has been speculated upon frequently. But again, just being that she was sitting in a bank of seats and it was shielded and cushioned somewhat, speculators think that the seats slowed her crash. Now she is known as Julianne Diller, and she's a librarian in the Bavarian State Collection of Zoology in Munich. And her autobiography is When I Fell from the Sky. It was released on the 10th of March in 2011, and she received a prize, the Karine Literature Prize, in 2011. And in 2019, the government of Peru awarded her the Order of Merit for Distinguished Services in the degree of Grand Officer. She actually returned to the crash site in 1998, and there are some photos of her visiting the area.
Here are a few practical tips derived from Julianne's experience. Number one, keep your cool and check yourself. When things go sideways, being calm can be difficult, but it's really important. Julianne's ability to take stock of her injuries amidst all the craziness was really important. So if you ever find yourself in a difficult situation, trying to take a deep breath and assess what you need to do first is a good place to start. Number two is to stick to what you know. Julianne followed a creek, which is a pretty smart move. So two things that came from this is number one, she had access to water. Number two, water takes you to people, generally speaking. She found a fishing lodge, and that's what ultimately led to her survival. A big part of surviving these situations is being able to be creative and using the resources that you have available. Our next story takes us into an unexpected space inside of a whale's mouth. Have you ever heard the saying of being in the wrong place at the wrong time? Well, imagine being lobster diver Michael Packard, who found himself in the belly of the beast, literally. Picture this, Provincetown, Massachusetts, where the chilly waters are home to migrating lobsters ripe for the picking. But as you can guess, it's no walk in the park.
Our story takes place in Provincetown, Massachusetts, where commercial lobster divers face cold waters to grab migrating lobsters straight off of the sandy ground or bottom of the ocean while they're in a powerful current. It's a dangerous job. It's usually a two-man team. The crewman at the surface watches the diver below, and they do that by keeping track of the bubbles that the diver emits. In this location, divers have been known to be pulled out to sea. Our story is about Michael Packard, who had his own share of close calls in the past. For years, he worked as an abalone diver on the West Coast in an area with great white sharks. And those sharks had a history of attacking divers. In June 2021, Michael was diving for a lobster early on a Friday morning. He had already had one dive and was entering the water for a second time around 8 in the morning. Michael said that he was descending about 35 feet, and all of a sudden, it felt like he was hit by a freight truck. Packard recalled later, all of a sudden, I felt this huge shove, and the next thing I knew, it was completely black. I could sense that I was moving. I could feel the whale squeezing with the muscles of his mouth. At first, Michael feared that he was inside a great white shark. But then he realized he couldn't feel any teeth. And he noticed that he hadn't suffered any obvious wounds. And so then Michael made the next step in realizing that he was inside of a whale's mouth. Michael said later, I was completely inside. It was completely black. I thought to myself, there's no way I'm getting out of here. I'm done. I'm dead. All I could think of was my boys. They're 12 and 15 years old. Michael did what any of us would do. He struggled within the whale's mouth. He said, quote, I was struggling, banging and kicking and thinking, there's no way I'm going to get out of this. The whale began shaking its head, so Michael could tell the whale did not like the movement. Michael guessed that he had been in the whale's mouth probably between 30 to 40 seconds before the whale surfaced. Michael said, quote, I saw light and he started thrashing his head side to side. And the next thing I knew, I was outside. The crewman who was with Michael that day, Josiah Mayo, saw the whale burst from the surface. Josiah's first thought was that it was a great white shark, just like Michael's initial thought. Then the whale flung Michael back into the sea. Josiah picked him up and radioed to shore from his perspective. We'd done a couple of dives. We'd caught a couple hundred pounds of lobster. Michael went down for a third dive and he drifted away. Then I saw a huge boil thrashing and smashing. Then Michael shot out of the water. I could see his little legs flying out of the water in just an eruption of white water. When Michael was first pulled out of the water, the first thing out of his mouth was, I was in the effing whale's mouth. Experts later would speculate that the humpback was a juvenile feeding on the sand lances that Michael was swimming among. Humpback whales are not known for being aggressive animals. When a humpback opens its mouth, it billows out, which blocks. So in all reality, this whale couldn't see that he is about to swallow Michael.
That's such a weird thought, if you would open your mouth and not be able to see what you're about to put in it.
It's just about quantity. Michael was released from the hospital that same afternoon with what he called a lot of soft tissue damage, but he had no broken bones. He reported that it might be his last dive in Provincetown. Incidents of humpback whales swallowing swimmers are extremely rare, but I just wanted to say I looked at this article from National Geographic, which came out shortly after Michael's account, because they wanted to set the record straight that it is impossible to be swallowed by a humpback whale. Because although a humpback can easily fit a human inside of its mouth, which can reach up to 10 feet, it's impossible for a whale to truly swallow a human, because the humpback's throat is roughly the size of a human fist, and it can only stretch to about 15 inches in diameter. It doesn't get very big, because these whales, which are classified as baleen whales, which include humpback, blue, gray, and mink whales, have special bristles for plankton, krill, and small fish. They don't really need a throat that big.
Yeah.
The sperm whale are the only whales that have throats large enough to actually swallow a human. And the sperm whales, they're actually eating larger sea life, like squid.
So what's the takeaway? Well, sometimes life throws you a curveball, or in Michael's case, a whale. But staying calm, trusting your instincts, and having a good story to tell afterward might see you through. The biggest takeaway in a situation like this is you got to take a moment, do some deep breathing, collect yourself, and use any resources you have to your advantage. Our next story centers on Bill Durden, a seasoned pilot and fisherman whose routine fishing trip turned into a harrowing fight for survival in the open waters of the Gulf of Mexico. Left adrift without a life vest or means of rescue, Bill's resilience and Navy training were put to the ultimate test as he battled exhaustion, dehydration, and uncertainty. Bill Durden, a gentleman in his early 60s, was a FedEx pilot and previous Navy pilot who embarked on the first day of grouper season on June 1st, aboard his 22-foot Grady White vessel. Greeted by warm, clear Wednesday weather, he had easy access to the water because his dock sat behind his vacation home on the Homosassa River, north of Tampa, Florida. So he had direct access to the Gulf of Mexico. He and his wife enjoyed their time in Florida and typically resided in Reno, Nevada.
On this beautiful day, Bill chose to venture out alone, without a fishing partner. He'd done this a number of times before and didn't really think a lot about it. He cruised along in flip-flops and did not wear a life jacket. He got pretty lucky early on and he pulled in two grouper fish. Then he kept going on and he was venturing approximately 25 miles offshore. He deployed his two fishing lines to trawl the waters of the Gulf of Mexico sometime between 1 and 1:30 in the afternoon, although he couldn't quite pinpoint the exact time. One of his fishing rods showed signs of activity. The braided line tightened as he realized he'd hooked onto something substantial. Despite the intense strain on the line, Durden was determined not to lose the rod because he'd only used it once before. And that's the moment where all conscious thought and consideration went out the window.
Oh, I'm just picturing where this could go from here. What could possibly be on the other end of that line? Is it going to capsize the boat? There's so many possibilities in my mind with that introduction. I can't wait to hear what happens next.
All it takes is a second for something to go wrong. Bill firmly grasped the foam handle with his palms and secured the bottom of the fishing pole against his abdomen, you know, bracing himself. These grouper fish are over a meter long. Some of them are quite large. He knew he was going in for a fight. This impromptu decision made in the heat of the moment would later prove to be a source of regret for Durden as it led to an agonizing experience for him, but also for his family and multiple search crews. Durden's fingers clung desperately to the rod. He'd been thinking, I will not let this thing go overboard. Unfortunately, he'd gone after the fishing rod without putting his boat in neutral, and he was aware of that when he went to the fishing rod. As he pulled the line pulled back at him, and it yanked him right out of his flip-flops, smack dab in the Gulf of Mexico, which would have maybe been okay, but the boat, since it wasn't in neutral, just kept going. And in a daze, he scanned his surroundings and tried to gather his wits.
Oh, I can't imagine what he was thinking. It probably took him a minute for it to sink in as his boat is slowly moving away from him, and he's in the water. That must have happened in slow motion, where it was just one small thing after another, and it settled in that he's in real trouble.
In a daze, he's scanning his surroundings and gathering his wits. He found himself without a life jacket, and the boat he'd fallen from is now a distant memory. His flip-flops remained on the boat's deck, not like this would be very helpful anyway, and his phone was out of reach as well. The boat drifted ahead of him, gently curving away, teasing close yet frustratingly out of reach. And at first, he tried to swim after it, but quickly realized that was not even possible. He released his pole and just figured, okay, now I'm going to have to make a plan. Reflecting on his life at that moment, Bill Durden remembered a time when he walked into the Navy recruiter's office at the age of 24 and declared his intention to become a pilot. Serving from 1980 to 1996, he'd risen to the rank of lieutenant commander. Now, two decades later, alone in the water, he drew upon his training and experiences of his Navy career. He said, I knew it was damn near impossible to swim to the shoreline. I figured the closer I got, the better my chance of getting rescued. I just had to have a game plan. I had to do something. So I swam really slowly. He started swimming toward the east. He had learned how to drown-proof himself in the Navy, which is a skill that requires floating with very minimal effort that you put into it. He's switching between floating on his back and then paddling on his belly with his arms extended. He would just submerge his face for 20 to 30 seconds and then pull up for another breath of air and then flip to his back. With deliberate and measured movements, he engaged in some dog paddling just to do something to occupy his mind. But every motion was deliberate and cautious. He understood that reaching the shore was an impossible feat given the circumstances. But he was considering the time that it would take his wife, Lisa, to call the Coast Guard to report him missing because she was out of town visiting her mother in Bradenton. So he assumed it'd be at least a few more hours before she would return back to the vacation home and find that he hadn't returned from his day of fishing. It was 1:30-ish when he went overboard. The salt water was stinging his nose and his throat, and his shirt was rubbing uncomfortably against the skin under his arms. And then thirst began to overpower him. He said that he'd give his life savings for one bottle of water. He was wishing and hoping a partially empty water bottle or Coke bottle would float by, but he had no luck. The Gulf waters were approximately 85 degrees, and a gentle breeze just a few miles an hour wafted over small waves measuring less than a foot. So luckily, he had good weather. A few hours passed before nightfall. A boat had passed by Durden, maybe 100 yards away. He got a glimpse of it and then lost it behind a wave. Another glimpse, another wave. Desperation overcame him, and he was flailing his arms and screaming, "Man overboard and over here!" But regrettably, the boat disappeared into the distance. That was clearly a low point. He said, "After that boat passed me, I knew I was there for the night, and that was a sad, sad feeling." At the time of day he had been dreading had arrived, which is evening. Out in the Gulf around 8:30 p.m., it started to get dark, and he watched the sunset and the stars emerge in the sky. At this point, Bill had already been doing his unsinkable swim for 8 grueling hours. He was exhausted, and he was still fantasizing about opening an ice-cold bottle of water. Back at home, Durden's wife, Lisa, had returned to their vacation house and found that Bill hadn't returned from fishing. She was concerned right away because they had just replaced the boat's battery the day before. So in her mind, it was something had happened to the boat. She called Sea Tow, which is a 24-hour boat towing operation, to see if Bill had made a phone call to them. And they said, nope, he has not made any contact, and it would be wise to call the Coast Guard right away, which she did. And again, in general, Lisa wouldn't have been concerned about Bill going fishing alone, but the fact that he wasn't there when she got back was concerning, again, just because of the battery. And it was getting dark, so I'm sure he wasn't usually out on the water after dark. Durden did not believe he was facing imminent death, but fear gnawed at him nonetheless, which makes sense. It would be impossible to be out there without any fear, but he did remain calm. He knew that if he didn't remain calm, the chances of him surviving were much more slim. He contemplated the things that he would do if he had the opportunity to, such as purchasing a life vest and spending more time with his friends and family. As Bill was floating at around 12 hours overboard, he heard some splashing, which made him nervous. But then the sound subsided. He started to calm down, and then he noticed that something was sucking on his foot. Remoras are a type of harmless sucker fish, and they started to attach themselves to his feet. And at first, he was trying to get them off, kicking his feet, and then he just gave up and was like, well, the more the merrier, and just let them go for it. Bill traversed reefs whose sounds resembled bacon sizzling in a pan. He wondered about the mysterious creatures lurking beneath him. At one point, as Bill's floating in the water, something sizable, possibly a dolphin, nudged at his toes, but he couldn't bring himself to look down to see what it was. He was earnestly hoping to avoid any bites that would draw blood, because obviously the last thing he wanted to do was attract sharks. He thought he glimpsed one at one point, but it turned out to be 10 inches in length. Durden saw what looked like a helicopter in the night, but it turned out to be a couple miles off. He'd been attempting to move in the eastward direction, but then during the night, he realized he'd started going the wrong direction due to his fatigue, and the dark conditions made it really difficult to navigate. He would not let himself consider death. He ruminated on the fact that this would be such a stupid way to die. He said, "I was really pissed at myself for being so dumb. I thought this is too stupid to die over. I'm retiring, and I'm going to get at least one of those retirement checks."
Oh, yeah. Gosh, he's in the hallucinating stage. Things are not looking good at this point for Bill. I'm so glad that his wife fought for him, though, knowing his skills and his background, and hopefully convinced everyone to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Hopefully that gave her some peace, too, in this moment, you know, having that feeling that at least he knows what to do. Bill had a stroke of luck when he found a buoy to hang on to, which helped him save some energy. But at that point, like you mentioned, he was in a difficult state. He was dry heaving. He had diarrhea. His tongue was swelling in his mouth, and it was bone dry. Of course, his mouth was bone dry. He was drifting in and out of sleep while hanging onto this buoy. Then he heard a noise overhead and looked up. At first, he wasn't sure if he could trust himself given his earlier hallucination, but then realized it was a 3x3 foot drone, and it hung around for 10 to 15 minutes above his head. And then he was elated because he thought, okay, somebody's actually looking for me. The Coast Guard, they're on their way. But then nothing happened for about 15 to 20 minutes until later he saw a flare in the sky, and shortly thereafter, the roar of an airplane engine, which was the Coast Guard's AC-130 that had spotted. Our officer Petty Jacob Latour appeared out of a small window near the wing of the C-130 plane. For 2 hours on Thursday morning, all they'd seen was expanse of water. 18 miles offshore, southwest of Arequipa, Latour refocused his gaze. Out of nowhere, I spotted a brightly colored object in the water. As I looked closer, it was someone waving at me. It was Durden, clad in his vibrant yellow fishing shirt. So go Bill, because if he hadn't been wearing a bright yellow fishing shirt, he may never have been found. When Bill spotted the Coast Guard, he said, "I started waving like crazy. Oh my God, so much relief. It was like an angel appeared in the sky." Petty Officer Colton Campbell geared up and plunged into the water. They skillfully loaded Durden into a basket and hoisted him into the belly of the helicopter. Campbell said he really didn't seem in bad shape. He was thirsty. Durden had harbored confidence he'd be located once daylight broke, but the salt water had taken the toll on his body. He was suffering from pretty significant sunburns, and he had sores all over his body. Of course, the diarrhea, pounding headache, and yeah, he was thirsty to say the least. Words escaped him slowly, and he stumbled through sentences, and the first thing that he asked for was Gatorade. His wife, Lisa, was there to greet him when he reached the shore, and she expressed her love for him, and he, of course, reciprocated the sentiment. His sister was also there. She had driven through the night from Atlanta. Once on land, Durden called his son and expressed his gratitude to all the search teams. He initially didn't go to the hospital. He just wanted to go to his bed. But after sleeping for 13 hours, he awakened with difficulty speaking and breathing, and Lisa just took him to the hospital. In the following days, doctors closely monitored him for signs of exposure and dehydration while tending to his sores that dotted his body and his sunburn. Durden affirmed his intention to return to the water, but he made a solemn promise to himself that he would never venture out for fishing alone again. Shortly after his rescue, Bill said, "For the last couple of nights when the sun goes down, I get knots in my stomach, but I'll go back out on the boat. I just won't go alone. Today, I bought 4 automatic self-inflating life vests, and I'm going to buy some other rescue equipment. I'm so thankful to the Coast Guard. They're the reason I'm here. I feel grateful to be alive, and I want to not think about it for a while." Bill attributed his survival to his naval training. Here's some takeaway from Bill's story. 1, always inform someone about your plans. Whether you're headed out for a fishing trip or outdoor adventure alone, make sure to inform a trusted person about your plans, including your destination and your expected return time. This ensures that someone knows where to look for you if you encounter trouble. 2, wear a life vest can be a lifesaver in unexpected situations like falling overboard. It provides buoyancy and increases your chance of staying afloat until help arrives. You want to make sure that you're wearing a properly fitted life vest when on the water, regardless of what your swimming ability is. 3, carry emergency equipment. Bring with you the essential emergency gear, like a fully charged cell phone in a waterproof case, signaling device like flare or a whistle, and a first aid kit. These tools can help you attract attention and provide basic medical assistance if you're waiting rescue. 4 is stay calm and preserve energy. In challenging situations, maintaining a calm demeanor is crucial. Panic can deplete your energy and impair your decision-making. Bill made a deliberate approach to conserve his energy by alternating between floating and paddling, which helped him endure hours in the water until rescue arrived. What really helped Bill in this situation is that he trusted his training. Bill had a background as a Navy pilot, which equipped him with valuable skills and mental resistance. He was able to draw upon his training. He was able to remain focused on staying afloat and navigating in the water, which ultimately aided in his survival. Training and preparation can make a significant difference in crucial moments. Being mentally prepared can be invaluable. When you know you have some skills under your belt that can help you through a difficult situation, it can help reduce anxiety. Thank you for joining us on this special journey through some of our most popular survival stories. We hope you found inspiration and valuable insights from these stories that highlight making difficult decisions under extreme circumstances. As we continue our mission to share captivating narrative of survival, we invite you to support the podcast by leaving a review on your preferred platform. Your feedback helps us grow and reach more listeners who may benefit from these stories. If you have a survival story you'd like to share, or if you'd like to simply connect with us, you can reach out to us at thecruxsurvival@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at thecruxpodcast. Your stories and messages mean the world to us, and we look forward to hearing from you. Once again, thank you for your continued support. Until next time, stay safe and keep exploring and seeking adventure. This is Casey McIntosh signing off from the Crux True Survival Podcast.
Tune in for the recap of the top five episodes next time on The Crux.